The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to a special edition of the Space Show this Monday evening. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements before we get started with our program tonight. This will be a 90-minute version show, so still watch the clock if you would like to get a call into our guest, Anthony Longman, or an email. Make sure you do it while we still have time to discuss what it is that you're contacting us for. Don't let the time run out on you. And we hope to hear from you for sure. So we're expecting to hear from you. We have a show tomorrow night and then Hotel Mars on Wednesday. And we do have programming scheduled for Friday, but my people have not confirmed that back to me with the needed material, so we may or may not watch the website for that. And then we have a Sunday Space Show, as always. And then just a note about power shutdowns and things that have been affecting the Space Show. We understand that our beloved utility company, Pacific Gas and Electric, is taking another 700,000, give or take, people in 22 Northern California counties offline again tomorrow. That'll be tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon through Thursday sometime. I do not yet know if my part of Petaluma, California is impacted. I'm in the southernmost part of Sonoma County. That's where Petaluma is, just a few miles away from Marin County, which is 100% offline or 99% offline. And there is news on Marin County tomorrow, and a big portion of it will remain offline. But I don't yet know my situation. I will use the website to keep you posted, so hopefully I'll be able to do the program like I am right now, and I'll stay with power, but it's not within my control. So do check the website to see if there are any updates, because I think I will have time to let you know if they're cutting my power off. So that's where we stand on that. So a couple of other messages. Our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. As a talk show, the toll-free number is our preferred way of getting a hold of us and talking to our guests. We prefer that you use it over and above the other forms, which include email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and also posting on our blog. And if you do want to post a comment on our blog, it is thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right to the upcoming show menu. And the program tonight with Anthony Longman is the first program listed. Open that page, that is our blog, and down at the bottom you'll see comments. And just write your question or your comments there and post it. As soon as you do that, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. And please remember, you do not, let me repeat, do not need to log in to Discuss, which is our blog comment program. You can do so as a guest, and it's much easier. And we do hope to hear from you. But again, toll-free number is the preferred way, 1-866-687-7223. Our website newsletter is posted at our website, thespaceshow.com, and that's on the upper right side. When you look at it and see the programs for this week, in addition, you'll see, if you scroll down, all of the programming we have planned, taking us through to the end of the year. And we only have a few dates that are not that remain available. We're almost booked out for 2019, and we are now starting on filling the first quarter of 2020, which is hard for me to believe, but that is what's happening. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or quickly download the program. It is gift-giving time. We're coming up on it, so we do have a Space Show store. You get there by clicking on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show. Perhaps you'll find some Space Show logo wear or another gift idea for your favorite Space Cadet or Space Show listener. We hope you will, and of course your feedback is always welcome as well. And then there is a Listen Live button in the upper left menu, so this is important. This tells you and others how to listen to live broadcasts, which is what we're doing right now. Archives on the website, which are compressed MP3s, and then podcasts, including Alexa. A couple of the podcast players are embedded on our website, but we are in iTunes, which is now mostly for a PC, Apple Podcast, Overcast. Those are all Apple products. And then we're in iHeartRadio, and we're in TuneIn. And I understand from Android users that pretty much any of the Android podcast apps, if you search for it, The Space Show, can pick up our podcast. So if you have any questions, difficulties, challenges, I would like to hear from you. On iHeartRadio, we're having trouble with them properly displaying our logo. Their customer service is not what you would call ideal by any means, but I'm working on that problem, so you'll basically see the text for The Space Show on iHeartRadio. If you have any questions about any of this, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also, do remember that we are a listener-supported program, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit, which means that you, the listener, support us with your contributions. We would not be doing these programs without your financial support. That's not an exaggeration designed to do fundraising. That is a simple, factual, unabashed truth. And we are coming up on the end of the year, and our annual campaign will shortly be starting in early November. This is the time we replenish, having pulled down to almost zero, our coffers from our fundraising a year ago this time, which took us through to the end of 2019. So what we do now takes us through the end of the year and for 2020, and we'll define the kind of space show we have and the frequency and a bunch of other features and things that we have. We're also going to be looking at raising enough money to go with digital hybrids, and it's going to be expensive, as I've explained on other shows, but we are still under the threat of AT&T stopping all and landline telephones starting in January, and it's hard to get a straight answer from AT&T if we're included in that, but they say they want to get rid of all of them, and they have authority to do that from the FCC and the Public Utilities Commission. So if that happens, we definitely need to find a way to upgrade to digital hybrids, because that's the device that allows a phone line to come into a live mix and broadcast live. And our hybrids are all analog, and they don't do well on digital. So that's a little bit of the news, and we hope you will support us. And again, remember, if you pay federal taxes, you get a tax deduction. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a tax deduction. And our nonprofit parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Don't forget, we also accept sponsorships. We have a few available for the new calendar year. Remember, they do eat into listener talk time, so we can only do a few, but they get banner ads running across our homepage, which they can change as often as they want. And on the full-length shows like tonight, I read a sponsor message. On the shorter shows, I give a shout-out to each sponsor. So for the first segment tonight, we certainly thank Northrop Grumman as a sponsor. They are a leader in global security, providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for the private sector as well as governments on a global basis. And they have capabilities and technologies that go undersea to outer space and cyberspace. We are also appreciative of the Space Foundation as a sponsor. They're coming up on their 36th Space Symposium. They're always in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. This year, it's March 30th to April 2nd. Connect, engage, and get a lot of business done all in one place at the 36th Space Symposium. Their website, one-stop shopping, spacesymposium.org. AIAA sponsors us. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They do 5 really great programs a year. By the way, they're the sponsor of this year's IAC that many of you may have attended last week. And they, you know, their engineers work in the field. Their members, their engineers, are the guys that are out there developing and making aerospace happen. They also have a decades worth, many decades worth of peer-reviewed papers that you can access. And you do not have to be an engineer to join. Remember, I'm not an engineering member. I'm a regular AIAA member. So check them out at AIAA.org, a truly great organization with networking beyond the stars. Moonword sponsors us for the first segment. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And we are deeply appreciative of our sponsors. You will hear from our other sponsors in the second segment of today's program. Our guest, who I mentioned just a few minutes ago, Anthony Longman, graduated from Cambridge University and was licensed as an architect in the UK before coming to Los Angeles, where he worked initially in hands-on house remodeling. This developed into residential design practice for 25 years, as well as collaborations in the film industry, high-end litigation graphics, and landscape design. In 2008, he became interested in space habitat design, focused on including landscape as a primary design driver. In 2013, he began a 6-year collaboration with Dr. Skelton, the originator of the math for engineering, Tenskritti. I'm going to screw that word up. Tenskritti, right?
Structure. Tenskritti.
Tenskritti, okay. Who's, you'll have to tell us what that is. Whose matchless efficiency makes them ideal for space. He has been awarded an IAC Phase 1 research grant to explore adding an iterative structural expansion capability. He has, in 2016, had an enlarged team, including Dr. Joel Sercel of TransAster Corporation, who's been a guest on the space show twice, I believe. And he was recently awarded a 2-year NIAC Phase 2 grant to continue his research. He just presented at the SSI 50-year Space Settlement Conference in Seattle. That is how I came to know of Anthony and his work. That's because he was talked about when we did the debrief show with John Jossi and Kim Holder, and they both mentioned Anthony on that debrief show. Anthony, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Oh, thank you, David. I'm very well. How are you, yourself?
I am doing fine. So what is Tenskritti?
Tenskritti. Tenskritti is Tenskritti. Really interesting.
Dan, this is going to be one of those Oklahoma tongue twisters. Okay, so what is it?
Okay, Tenskritti is a word that was coined by Buckminster Fuller, I think in the 60s, although the origination of the idea probably is shared with a sculptor who was a student of his, Snelson, I think his last name was. But essentially, a Tenskritti structure is made of sticks and strings where the sticks do not touch each other, but the strings connect everything together. And the simplest version of that is 3 sticks, you know, like a spiral, mm-hmm. held together by 9 strings. It's a bit like a teepee sort of structure, if you can sort of imagine that. So the sticks are only in compression, and that makes it very efficient because they don't have to resist bending. So my buddy, Dr. Skelton, invented the mathematics for engineering these structures. Before 2010, nobody knew how to engineer these. And he proved that they provide the most mass-efficient solutions to the 5 classical problems of mechanics, which makes it very, very good for structures in space where you have to minimize the mass in the launch. So it's become a big thing for use in space.
Is it being used any place for real?
Oh, yeah.
Where is it used?
You know, I know that quite a lot of, there's a lot of satellites, you know, anything that needs to have a large framework deployed, the tendency is to use tensegrity engineering for that. And in fact, our habitat is engineered with tensegrity engineering because it provides the most mass efficient solution. And that's a good thing, saving mass on launch.
So I'm looking at a design. I mean, this isn't how he's going to start the show, but I'm looking at a tensegrity design on the internet. So, and it's green and red. Okay, those are the colors they're using.
Right, right.
So the green looks a little bit thicker, and the red looks like thinner. So the red would be strings, and the green would be the other part of it?
Yeah, the compression elements.
But they are all connected, so I don't understand how the strings hold it together and the others don't.
Well, it's...
I'm sorry to put this on you.
Visualize if you haven't seen it, but if you imagine three sticks that are arranged in a sort of slightly spiral arrangement, and then all the points of all the sticks are joined together by
strings. Okay, I'm seeing that, and they got on this website, it's turning on me. So I've got three green sticks, and then I've got everything connected at the point by red strings.
Yeah, there should be nine of them.
Yeah, but, well, it's turning too fast. I can't count. But the green sticks are connected to the red strings, but they're not connected to each other.
That's the essence of tensegrity. In fact, to give you a sort of a practical sense of this, all vertebrate animals like you and I, for example, we have skeletons that are made of sticks, essentially, and the strings are the tendons and the muscles and so on, the ligaments that hold everything together. And nature uses tensegrity as a design paradigm a lot because it's efficient and because it's flexible. You can change the shape of the structure if you just shorten the length of the strings, like muscles change in length. It allows you to have structures that change shape, and that can grow rather easily because you just have to make the stick a little bit longer and the string a little bit longer, and you've got a bigger structure. And that's one of the reasons that it's a powerful paradigm.
So that I see they've got arches, you know, that are made and towers. And, you know, I don't know if I'm on a great page for this or not. I'm just clicking on the picture that came up when I put in the word tensegrity, and it's on Wikipedia. But very interesting. I know that's not why you're on the show, but fascinating. I've learned something tonight. Thank you.
And in the application of the math, Bob Skelton wrote the math for this, and it turns out that you don't have to have a physical stick to act as the compression member. In the case of our habitat, the compression member is the atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure provides the push against which the strings pull. And so all the floors are basically tensegrity constructions made of just meshed together, woven together cables. You know, this very specific arrangement, and the atmospheric pressure is what they push against or what they pull against.
Interesting. Is that what caused you to get involved in these habitats, or that was a byproduct involved?
I'll tell you a story because it's kind of interesting. When my wife and I moved up to the mountains, I'd say about 11 years ago, we were living at 6,500 feet, and off of our front deck, we could see this incredible, almost semicircular cross-section of the valley, and it was full of trees and meadows. And because I'm a designer, and I think about living spaces and, you know, and what makes life pleasant to live, I thought to myself, I wish we could figure out how to make more of this landscape, you know, and because who wants to live in a tin can in space, really, you know? What you want is more of what we like here. So that was the kicking off point for that. And I started tinkering with the designs, and I applied for a couple of grants, which I did not get. And then somebody mentioned Dr. Skelton, Bob Skelton's name. And at the time, he was in San Diego at UCSD there. And he'd worked on the space telescope and a number of other programs. So he was sort of a big shot.
Okay.
Anyway, I called him up and I said, look, I I wanted to talk to you because I think, from what I can see, tensegrity might help me make landscapes in space, which is what I want to do. And he said, yes, come and see me. So we met. It turns out he had been thinking about applying tensegrity to habitats, rotating habitats, and so we hit it off, and we applied that summer for a grant, and we were awarded, I think mostly on the strength of Bob's credentials, but the idea was, what we proposed, is that you can design a habitat that can start small and grow and get much bigger. And the reason, why would that be a good thing? Because one of the big problems with the classical rotating space habitat is that to be comfortable, to provide 1G, which we need, and to be comfortable so you're not getting dizzy from too much rapid rotation, it has to be big. It has to have a, if you include this, the shield around the outside that you need, it's probably about a third of a mile across. That's a really big structure. And you've got to think, well, how are we going to be able to afford to build something like that? We don't get a single cent of revenue from it until it's actually complete. That's the big hurdle, is, you know, just a huge, huge step that you have to take to build something like that and then get revenue from it. It's too hard. So the idea we had, and which is why we got a grant, is, well, maybe it's possible to design a structure that begins small, like a baby begins small. You know, we don't give birth to full-sized adults. We give birth to babies. And then we grow them, and we feed them, and, you know, they become more capable. Why couldn't we make a space habitat like that? And so that idea kind of resonated with the reviewers on the review board for the Nine Grand. And we got a phase one. And it's interesting, though. We really didn't know where we were going. It took us, we had a year or two out in between, but then we got a phase two, which is a 2-year grant. And it was only towards the end of that 2-year grant that we finally found the right paradigm, the right geometry to support growth. Because when you start thinking about it, there's a lot of different ways that you can imagine you might be able to make something that grows. And none of them worked except for this one. So that's the story of, you know, how I came to be talking to you today.
Now, you're talking about free space habitats, not habs on the surface of the moon or Mars, right?
Correct, yes. We follow Gerard K. O'Neill's idea that, you know, he asked his PhD students the question. He was a professor, I think, at
Princeton.
Princeton,
yeah.
Yeah, and he asked his students a question: is the surface of a planet the right place for an advanced technological civilization? And after some discussion, they came to the conclusion that perhaps it wasn't, because you're at the bottom of a gravity well. And if you're an advanced technological civilization, you want to be going places in space, and why would you want to have to climb out of a gravity well every time to do it? So why not make really nice places to live in space? And the kind of things he was talking about were, you know, 10 miles long and a mile across and without a million people. And the idea of how you could actually build that or afford to build it was very sketchy. And although he testified in front of Congress, you know, on the subject, it sort of crested and then crashed as an idea. And it's only really now that we're getting back to it on a basis that I think is hopefully sustainable.
Would you build a structure like this on the surface? Would tensegrity work on the surface of the moon or Mars too, or is this only free space application?
You can apply tensegrity very successfully to planetary surfaces, but what we're talking about, a rotating structure, that has to be in free space.
Okay. So that's how you got interested in this, and then you've come up with some designs. And you have a slideshow on the website, right?
Correct.
So tell us what we can see on the.
Yeah, well, I have a much bigger slideshow, but I wasn't able to get it all up on the website. But what you can see is, I think it's about six slides or so. You can see the mature habitat in cross section, and that gives you the idea of an interior landscape. And you can see a cross-section, and this is the result of a growth process. And then you will also see the first deployment of the habitat structure, which is only 17 meters across and I think 26 meters long. And that's inflated from a payload that can be launched on a single rocket, probably a new Glenn when that gets built. So the point is that there's a mechanism that allows you to grow. In fact, you can see the first two steps of the very small habitat that is deployed to begin with. And the method of expansion is that you split the interior floor and hold on to the edges of the floor, and the atmospheric pressure pushes the walls out sideways, left and right. And now you have gained width. And if you keep adding layers on like that, which have the same capability as to split and go sideways, then you develop into this large-scale finished shape that you see there with the interior landscaping. That's how you grow from a small seed to a large habitat like that. One of the key things that we wanted to do was not only to get affordability through growth, but also to ensure that we made a habitable space. And to my sense, habitability equates here to large volume. You've got to have a large interior space. And so the design problem that we set ourselves was, how can we do both of those things, have a structure that grows, and it grows so that it generates a large interior volume. Those are the two, basically the two objectives that produce what you see in front of you here. The one other thing that I should add is that we wanted to ensure that you could use the sunlight, that the classical arrangement for a space habitat is to have diagonal mirrors left and right, which we do. And all the sunlight that the habitat can use has to come through the walls, because it can't come through the floor. So you've got to be able to share the sunlight between growing crops in the walls and lighting the habitable interior. So how do you do that? And if you look, you can see, when you're looking at the large images, you can see that the walls are comprised of groups of floors, agricultural floors, that are inclined in a sort of leaning arrangement. So that it's a bit like a louver blind. And so that you can have the light go directly to the growth floors. And when it's time for nighttime for the crops, then you activate a switching mechanism on the shutters for the crops, and that directs the light up the slot between the level of blind blades, and it bounces off a central reflector. And in the middle of the central reflector is also a zero-G workshop space. So the idea is you can develop industrial processes in zero-G that you can't do on Earth here. They're starting to do some of that already on the space station in terms of making very high-quality, high-transparency glass fiber, optical fibers. So we hope to generate an economic engine in the zero-G space in the middle to help the habitat support itself.
You have a note from Todd, and he said, since you're rotating this, when you start out small, are you rotating it small? And as you grow it and get bigger, you're rotating the larger structure too?
Yes. The one other point I should make is that the structure is actually two concentric structures. The inner structure is a pressure hull, which has flexible pressure membranes on the walls, also transparent. And then the shield structure has transparent walls also. Those are made of fused silica. And it has a flexible, regular water sandwich floor. So, I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Todd wanted to know if when you start small, you're rotating the small structure, and as you allow it to grow, you're able to continue to rotate it.
To begin with, the first iteration, the one that you see on the pages there, will not rotate. It will only rotate after a shield structure has been built around it and a bearing has been assembled to join the two together. So once the bearing is installed between the inner structure of the pressure hull and the outer structure, which is the shield, then the pressure hull would start to rotate. That would be a few steps after the one that you're seeing right now. And the initial rate of rotation would probably be 4 RPM, which would give you the sort of radius that you would have by the time you've added a floor or so. You would have something like lunar gravity there. And at 4 RPM, you can get to Earth gravity at a radius of about 54 meters. So you need to add a few layers, but not that many. And one thing I should add, although this is, you can kind of see this from the larger illustration, is that we chose to grow the radius of the habitat in groups of five floors at a time. We had chosen a 4 meter floor-to-floor height, which will allow enough space, you know, for standing room plus services in the ceiling. And we grew in groups of five floors, so 20 meters at a time. And that way you can get from the initial size out to 1G in about 12 steps. And every growth iteration is basically a repeat of the one before. In the section, they always look the same. It's just that the radius gets bigger.
How many people does this space station hold?
At maturity?
Yeah, at maturity.
It can support a population of about 8,000 people.
Wow.
And you have about 90 acres of managed woodland, which you can see in the interior there.
Oh, hold on. Where do I see that?
Well, all of the trees and the green space in the middle, that's 90 acres.
Okay.
And you have it's a bit like a river, although it's not really a river, but it's like a long linear lake that sort of meanders between the hills. There are about six hills on each side, and each hill has a crater in the top with a small lake. So I think this would be kind of a cool place to live, actually. I wanted to design something that felt like kids would enjoy exploring it. You know what I mean?
At what size do you start out, and how long does it take you to get to 8,000 people?
Well, the cool thing about this arrangement, where you have a growth process that is up to you to control the rate at which you grow, what you do is you establish as many money-making concerns as you can. I mean, like they're already making money out of the space station, not enough to cover the costs, but the point is they are. You know, people pay to run experiments on the space station. And even in the small version of this, which is, I think, about eight times the volume of Skylab or something like that, you are going to have the opportunities to develop money-making activities. So you will grow when the business is good, you know, and when you... Oh, and sorry, one other thing that I have to stress here is that it's really important that there's a partnership here between asteroid mining and space habitat development. We can't really contemplate doing something like this until asteroid mining or lunar surface mining, whichever works more easily, until that's going. And you mentioned that you'd had Joel Cassell on your show a couple of times. Joel and I work very closely together. I do most of his illustration work currently.
Okay.
And so the idea here is, you know, with asteroid mining, if you find a really good target asteroid that has maybe 12% water by weight in it, tied up in hydrates, and then you can extract the water and turn it into rocket fuel, propellant or whatever, to sell to NASA or the Russians or whoever's up there. And then you get left with slag, you know, which is the debris from the, you know, the leftover from the process of refining. We think we can use that for the shielding of the habitat. And in a, you know, the habitat, even though it looks like, well, it is obviously, it's a really big structure, but about 99% of it is in the shield in terms of the mass. So it's really important that you have a good materials base, a good mining sector. And you've got to have, once that is established, then you can look to grow habitats like this, and they will each help the other, each feed each other.
What's the smallest size the habitat would start with?
Well, the radius of the initial deployment is 8.5 meters, so it's 17 meters across diameter and 26 meters long before it expands sideways. And if you look carefully, you'll see there's a little blue figure in the cross section, which gives you a sense of scale to it. It's hard to say how long it would take to grow. It really depends on the level of economic activity. If times are booming, you might grow this from beginning to end in perhaps 25, 30 years. If you figure 12 radio expansions and then 4 linear steps, so it's about 16 episodes of growth. And if you do once every 2 years, that's 32 years. I mean, that would be, to my sense, an optimistic growth rate.
How many people do you start off with in free space? What's the beginning number of occupants?
Well, to begin with, it would not really be what you would call habitable at the beginning. It would be professional astronauts. What you'd basically be doing is setting up the life support systems. We want to have a bioregenerative life support system where essentially it's like the planet in the sense that plants keep us alive. Plants and the animals and us have these material cycles, and we will want to replicate the same idea in the habitat as starting as early as possible. But we would have to wait until if you look at the larger illustrations, you can see that there are docking ports at either side at the center. Those don't let sunlight through. So you have to grow the habitat large enough that it's bigger than that before you can get sunlight directly through the sidewalls. So that would be the event that triggers the real initiation of bioregenerative life support, with plants carrying most of the weight, most of the load there.
I have another email. Barbara is in Houston. And she says, you're talking about free space habitats, but then you're talking about mining an asteroid or surface mining of the moon. So I'm assuming this free space station or habitat has got to be either an asteroid or lunar orbit or very close to it, correct?
Actually, not really. So I know a little bit about Joel's work. And my understanding of it is that the way asteroid mining, and I think it's probably going to be asteroid mining that works for this. That's just my hunch. But how you go about mining, first of all, you have to prospect. You have to essentially use telescopes, very custom designed telescopes that are purpose-built for this purpose, to locate suitable targets for mining. And these asteroids, as we know, fly through the Earth-Moon system all the time. And what you really want to look for is a candidate asteroid that has the 12% water that you're looking for. And with sufficient progress in this area, we should be able to discern just through telescopes, through optical sensing, which are the likely candidates. So we can pick an asteroid that's the right size, not too big, so that we can swallow it in our asteroid mining ship. And you have to catch it because it's probably moving with respect to the Earth at a good, a couple of kilometers a second or something. So you've got to be able to rendezvous with it and then bring it back to the Earth-Moon system. So I think the destination of all asteroid mining operations, at least in the near future, that we're going to start out with. We're going to start out with the asteroids that are in suitable orbits close to the Earth's orbit and that are not too different in terms of velocity from the velocity of the Earth. So that way you can bring the results of, what you want is rocket fuel here in the Earth-Moon system. So you choose your targets. So that's what you end up with. And hopefully we can use the residue from the mining for shielding.
How do you get the components up there? You mentioned the New Glenn. You're planning on launching them on a big rocket, such as the New Glenn or maybe a SpaceX rocket.
Right. Well, the initial deployment that you see, yes, that would be launched on a New Glenn. And all of the sort of high-tech parts that are required to expand the pressure hull, yes, it'll have to be launched from the ground. And again, I can't emphasize strongly enough that the aim here is to make an economic engine, something that is part of a process where you're developing an economy in space. That's how this is going to work. And that again, that's based on asteroid mining as a sort of a ground, a foundation.
When would this be ready? How far out is it in the future? Let me put it that way. Are we looking at 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well,
what do you think?
I'm going to make a sort of a tentative stab at this. I would say that there's a good chance that we will see asteroid mining missions in perhaps 5 years. That's a guess on my part, but I don't think it's far off.
Okay.
From what I see, and obviously to develop and launch the seed stage of a habitat like this, that takes some, it takes getting the funding together, you know, arranging getting the partnerships to operate, and then, you know, getting the commitment of funds. So an investor has to take a risk. So I'm going to say that, and this is just, you know, this is a hypothetical guess, but I would say that within 10 years, we could see something like this deployed. This is the initial stage. It might happen sooner, but I'm thinking 10 years is a fairly safe bet.
What do you think?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, and then I'll ask
you.
Well,
what I was going to say is that this is, I'm tempted to say this is not rocket science, but of course that's a joke, but this is not mechanically complex. It's nowhere near as complicated as building a rocket engine, you know, where you're dealing with very high temperatures and very high pressures and, you know, enormous stress on the materials. This is not like that. This is essentially, this is like unfolding a tent in space, except it's a very specialized tent. It's a bit like, and that's the metaphor, I think, that is appropriate, using flexible materials it's essentially an inflatable structure. And yes, it's complicated, more complicated than just a balloon, but it's not that hard to see how it could work. It's just, I think you have to get around the idea. First of all, we're used to thinking of habitable space in outer space being enclosed in metal. You know, we have this idea that it has to be rigid. And this is a real departure from that. The rigidity is in the shell, but that's a separate structure. And so what you have is something that's, think about how a snail lives inside its shell. The shell grows, or a nautilus, you know.
Uh-huh.
But the creature inside is soft, and it's essentially pneumatic. And this is like that. You know, the protection is the shell. The shield, and so you can take advantage of the flexibility of the part inside to promote growth. Anyway, that's how it seems to me.
What do you have as an initial budget? I shouldn't have asked that.
Well, we have done some cost studies.
I hope so.
Yeah, we have, for the whole thing, soup to nuts. And I'll tell you what the number is, but the point to understand is not the number is as an absolute thing is not what really matters. What matters is that the context is in cash flow, in circulation of, you know, economy. The absolute numbers are much less important than the movement of goods and services, and that's the key here. I mean, to build the whole thing over a course of 25, 30 years might be $1 trillion. I mean, but the point is, that's not really what matters. What matters is the process. and you run the process so that it runs in the black rather than in the red. And that is what you would aim to do. And the question of how soon you can do that is dependent on external factors, one of which is the evolution of asteroid mining.
But if you spent this magical trillion-dollar number, and even if you got it to run in the black, to give this commercial company an acceptable return on investment for risk, time, all of those ingredients, then that would be a percentage of the $1 trillion that was invested.
Yeah.
So the $1 trillion actually does matter because it's a huge number.
Yeah, but the point is the trillion dollars is only it's the net result at the end. That's what you've expended by the time you built the whole thing. But along the way, you've been making money at every step along the way.
So it doesn't matter.
So you've made $1 trillion and you spent $1 trillion and you've got a habitat, you know.
Well, what kind of return do you get on it then?
Well,
I mean, your cash flows. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about that, because a cruise ship is a very good metaphor for this. You know, cruise ships have a carrying capacity of the large ones of about 8,000 people. So you can, one manifestation, one sort of embodiment of this idea is that this is a cruise ship, that it operates between the Earth and the Moon on a periodic orbit two or three or four times a month. And people, you know, pay to spend a vacation of the lifetime, or, you know, anybody who can afford to buy an apartment overlooking Central Park could afford to buy, an apartment in this habitat. And it would be like a prestige thing. And then you could have, you know, universities might have a campus there. I mean, it's just like another piece of real estate, except it happens to be in space, and it can do things because it's in space that you can't do on the ground. But I think that tourism will certainly be a big part of it. And I suspect that it will be linked to the economy of the lunar surface development. I don't know exactly how the orbital aspects of that work out, but I have a feeling that something will be worked out there.
And then how do you get to the mining destination, the surface of the moon or the asteroid? You have to have some kind of vehicle from the free space habitat to wherever you're going?
Okay, well, I don't see. As I understand it, I'm just sort of drawing on what I know about Joel's work. Is that the robot mining craft will bring back water, but it may also be able to bring back at least some of the slag, because if you think about it, it's swallowed this big asteroid and it's got to digest the thing. It may take, you know, 6 months or a year to digest the whole thing. I don't know exactly how it works, but so while it's on its way back to Earth and it's refining, it's bringing the material with it. So you end up with the materials in cislunar space where you want them. So we don't have to take the habitat to the asteroid. It's more the other way around.
Okay, we're at the halfway point, so I'm going to take our pause here and actually do it on time for a change. So, listeners, you can still call us. Excuse me. We would like to hear from you, and we do answer the phone during the break, and then we talk to you and put you on hold and open with you. 1-866-687-7223. And then email continues to be available, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Sorry about that, listeners. We're going to be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity as a whole. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by clicking on the Support the Space Show button at www.thespaceshow.com. Please make your tax-deductible contribution, which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or area code 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Space Show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston, and great to be here. And Anthony Longman is our guest, and we are talking about expandable, shielded, rotating, free space, space habs. We have a couple of sponsors for the second segment. Let me get that done real quickly. Space Development Network is talking about international lunar exploration, saying currently the mission would cost billions and a lot of companies and countries would not be able to afford to do it. Therefore, it may be that they need something else, and there are ways to do that. The Space Development Network has developed a webpage that describes a near-term end-to-end commercial transportation system in which international astronauts could participate in missions of lunar exploration. Using this approach, far more countries could afford to participate in these missions by purchasing seats from commercial providers at market prices. So check out the website. It is developspace.info/international. And also as a sponsor is Celestis. They are still, since 1997, the iconic pioneer of Memorial spaceflight. And they offer memorial space flights for the cremated remains of your loved one, about 1 gram. That's because it's very expensive, as we know, to go to space. You can also do DNA if you don't cremate, and you can also add your DNA to that of your loved one to symbolically make the journey, too. You can go suborbital, orbital. They're going to be returning to the moon soon. And at some point, they'll have Mars flights and free space and deep space flights. So you can get lots more information about this at Celestis.com. It's an amazing experience. A great ceremony goes with it. I've done it 3 times with my mom and my dogs. And you will be happy you honored and remembered a loved one this way, especially if your loved one liked space or was a space cadet. The National Space Society sponsors us. Remember, they have the great event, the ISDC. It's every year around Memorial Day. Coming in 2020, it's in Frisco, Texas at the end of May. And they have other great events during the year, like their workshop on space settlement. They have white papers. It's a 501c3. And check it out. They have a great publication called Ad Astra, which you will want to be reading. It's quarterly. Their website, space.nss.org. And then finally, our sponsor is the Integrated Space Plan, the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another and explore hundreds of individual elements in a lot more detail. Their website, thespaceplan.com. Join the discussion and see the interactive activities on the website and get your own full-color space plan. It comes in 2 varieties. It's very inspiring, suitable to be framed, and very educational for your children. Again, check it out, thespaceplan.com. And as I said, Anthony Longman is with us, and we're talking about his unique habitat. Anthony, what is the material that you use for the expandable part of the habitat?
Okay, well, the flexible walls of the pressure hull are almost certainly going to be made out of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, which can have as high as 92% transparency if it's made in a certain way. There's
okay.
A Japanese company that has developed that. And it would be probably between 1 and 2 millimeters in thickness with carbon fiber reinforcements. And our calculations show that it's a really remarkable material. It's extremely strong. So that would be the wall material. And it's quite likely that the floors will be made of essentially the same material since it has such desirable high-strength properties. But the floor structure will essentially be woven like a mat. And the design of everything is arranged. There'll be a lot of interior. You know how it's a little bit analogous to a suspension bridge, where you know, we take these for granted, but they're really quite remarkable structures, and they depend on these huge tension cables. Now, in our case, we wouldn't be having just a couple of really massive cables. We would have a whole bunch of much smaller cables. But the cables would, you can't see them in the illustrations because they're too small. But the cables were essentially anchored to the floor of the pressure hull and then trace a line going up the face of the sloping surfaces in an arc, like the arc of a suspension bridge cable. So that provides each of the floor surfaces in the wall can be tension across to this curved cable, like the if you imagine the suspension bridge turned on its side. So this keeps the inner edge of every floor, every cylindrical floor is tensioned back to this master tension cables, catenary cables going from one side of the habitat through the middle and across to the other side.
Do they ever wear out in a space environment?
The environment that these will be in is a normal Earth atmosphere, you know, mostly nitrogen atmosphere. Yes, there'll be some oxygen. So, you'll have the same sort of corrosion issues and maintenance issues that you have on something like the Golden Gate Bridge. Eventually, over time, the cables have to be replaced. But if you plan your maintenance right, that won't be a problem.
And then you said the shielding is what? It's steel inside, or you said rigid?
The shields, the left and right shield walls are made of fused silica blocks.
Okay.
So, and one other thing I should add is that, to fully answer your question, so the shield walls are fused silica blocks.
Okay.
And the shield floor is made of a sandwich, a three-layer sandwich. Basically, you have, if you think of it in percentages going from the outside, you have a 10% thickness on the outside. With the outside layer will be regolith slag from mining of the refining of the asteroid material.
Okay.
The water out. So you have like 10% there, which is basically a meteor bumper. And then you have like a 20% thickness of water. And this is all in bags, of course. Bagged water and bagged regolith slag. And then inside that, a 70% thickness of regolith slag again. The idea here is that water is a really good shielding material, one of the best, because it has a high proportion of hydrogen, and hydrogen is a really good shielding material because the nucleus is very stable, and you've got to stop incoming galactic cosmic rays, which are traveling, you know, they're the nucleus of broken atoms traveling at close to the speed of light, so they can pack a punch. And you need something to slow them down, and water is one of the best materials to do this. But water will be kind of expensive because you have the refining process to do it, and it's valuable for other purposes like rocket fuel. So we just have like a 20% thickness of water, and then that brings the energy level of the incoming cosmic rays down sufficiently that when they travel through the inner 70%, they don't generate more secondary radiation than you need to. In other words, it's sort of a compromise between cost and efficiency. So, and the point is that we design the overall shield so it can grow in thickness. When you first deploy, and when, you know, the little structure that you see in the picture there, the initial deployment, when that is first surrounded with a shield, which you can see in one of the illustrations, that shield is probably half a meter thick, and it's composed of the three layers, like we said. But over time, as this habitat grows and reaches the material size, the thickness of the shield will also have grown from half a meter to 5 meters. And we have an arrangement that whereby the layer of the shield that is water, what you want is to always keep the shield have the same proportional thickness even as it grows. And you can accomplish that by burying unused water bags on the inner side so that each time you add material, you add shielding material on the inside regolith, and you pump water into one of the new layers in between. If you measure things exactly right, you can keep your proportions as you grow. So it can be done. Excuse me.
So I have another email from you. Carl is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening tonight. And he says, I'm assuming you have to have a pretty advanced orbital construction or development company, or are you managing to do all of the construction on the ground and then just screw it together once you get to space?
I think that what will be put together on the ground is collapsed structures. A lot of this is basically all of the pressure hull, which is the only part that's going to come up from the ground. The shield is going to come from material in space. The pressure hull is made of all of flexible materials. And, excuse me. So that's what you'll be carrying up from the ground. You'll be carrying up the floor membranes and the wall membranes and the cables. So those will be carried up from the ground, and they will be strung together on the ground. They'll be connected together. What you then need to do is to unroll them in space and inflate them. so that they assume their intended shape.
Listeners, don't forget that our toll-free number, if you would like to call us, and there is lots of time, and this is a talk show, and we'd like to hear from you, like we say on every program, 1-866-687-7223. You can, of course, continue to use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, but we do prefer the phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. And for people to look out, or is this totally sealed, like no windows or no views? What do you do for looking out and kind of, you know, maybe passive recreation, I'll say?
Right. I think that we certainly will have some sort of viewing lounge. I haven't shown it, but it could most easily be arranged at the hub, at the docking port, see the ramp. You could surround those with a zero-G lounge. But I'm hoping that the interior landscape will be quite seductive. I mean, I don't know if any of your readers or listeners have ever been to the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disney World in Los Angeles.
Yeah, a lot of us have been there.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that this has a sort of something of the same quality of a sort of a magical landscape, because it will be sort of not Earth-like in the sense that it will wrap all the way around you. But what I think it will do is it will have a very intimate quality, very sort of embracing. If you look at the picture of the interior, the material landscape, the width of what I would call the river that snakes through the hills, that's about 30 feet across, 30, 40 feet across. And it's big enough to canoe on, you know, to take a rowboat. You could fish in it. You can imagine that the little sort of projections of the corners, you could have a little bay there. And actually, if you don't mind, I wanted to make another point, which is that and I haven't talked about this, but it's really important to grasp the landscape that you see at the end there. I want to talk a little bit about how that is developed.
Okay.
The landscaping on the sides, on the walls, on either side, that part can grow as the habitat grows, because once each of those cylindrical surfaces is deployed, it's there. You know, it's not going to change, and so you can develop the landscaping on it. And if you look at the interior, you can see that there are sort of I call the diagonal groups of four, they call them stacks. And you can see that the lower part of each stack, the lower five floors, has direct sunlight coming into it from the side. But the part above that does not. And if you look carefully, you will see that the part above that is like the crest of a sine wave, which goes up and down around the interior. So you have a sinusoidal land surface that's sitting on top of the agricultural stacks. And then there are bridges between the different levels, and the one set of sinusoidal surfaces is offset from its neighbor above and below by a half phase. So the crest of one sine wave aligns with the trough of the next one, which allows you to have a bridge across. This way you can walk from the bottom all the way up to the top, even though you're crossing the light shafts along the way. There are these bridges across the light shafts. So that part can develop as the habitat grows larger in radius. You can build all of that as you go. But the floor of the habitat, that's something that can only be built at the end. And the reason for that is that the habitat grows, to begin with, in a narrow V-shape with a very narrow valley base. And only when you get out to the 224-meter radius Only at that point do you then grow sideways to get the width. And that's just a function of how the growth mechanism operates. And I don't have illustrations to show exactly how that works. We're in the middle of filing a patent for some of this stuff. So the important thing to grasp is that the valley floor landscape does not occur until the relatively late stage of growth. So you're going to grow with a narrow width, and it's only after those 12 radial growth expansions that you then have the four sideways axial expansions that give you the really large 1G floor space. And so the population carrying capacity is going to be tied to that expansion of the outer floor. So it will have a relatively modest population until you reach 1G, at which point the population is going to grow quite radically. And at that point, at the same time you're growing sideways, you can start to develop the valley floor landscape. And there's an analogy I like to use here. If you imagine a five-story apartment building.
Okay.
And on top of the apartment building, on top of the five floors, you have a two-story penthouse. And on top of the penthouse, you have a roof deck, a roof garden. That's what you have here. So you've got five floors of continuous apartments and commercial and residential floor space with atriums. You can see some of the atriums at the edge of the section. And so on top of those five floors, you have a continuous urban mall space, essentially is the best way I can describe it, that varies in ceiling height between one and a half, two stories up to five stories under the peaks of the hills around around the habitat. So it can be, it's a very spacious interior space. And on top of that, you've got a roof garden, which is held up by a tensegrity framework. And Bob Skelton and his colleagues there have written software that will automatically solve for a tensegrity solution to any shape you care to deliver it. So there's no question that you can engineer the frame that will support the landscape like that. And it will probably have a meter or so of soil and then up 10,000 trees.
George is in Boston with an email. And listeners, it'd be great if you'd quit emailing. I say this every show. Use a toll-free phone. 1-866-687-7223. George says, what supplies power to this station? Is it nuclear? Is it solar? And what about the infrastructure? Does it have infrastructure power plants adjoining it or down the road, so to speak, from it? Can you go outside for spacewalks or drive around, say, in a lunar buggy of sorts if you're in a shielded spacesuit? What can you do in terms of recreation, and how does this unit get its power?
The power, we think that it can be run entirely on solar power. In some of the final illustrations, you can see that there is what I call a dorsal fin running all the way around the circumference of, I'm sorry, that's the radiators. Those are the radiators. The dorsal fin is the radiators. The solar panels will be on the underside of the outer floor. So the outer floor surface will be covered in solar panels.
And that'll supply the power for it and all of its functioning?
Don't forget, you're also getting sunlight through, you're getting a lot of sunlight because you're pumping sunlight in from a full load of sunlight from both sides of the habitat. And we think there's enough solar energy to run it, but we would like to think that it could be run just on solar, because I don't like the thought of a nuclear power plant going sideways. Anyway, but that's to be determined. I don't have a dogmatic position on that.
Now, what about going outside, driving? Well, there's nothing to drive around on, but I guess flying around or something, you know, if you wanted to go for a little short flight. Can you go outside? Can you do spacewalks? What can you do?
Well, I mean, yes, certainly one could do that. This prompts me to go off in perhaps a tangent. I don't know whether any of your readers have read a novel by Kim Stanley Robinson titled 2312, I think it was.
I know a lot of them have read all of his books, so probably probably many of them have.
Yeah. Well, 2312 is an interesting novel, and it had a lot. He talked a lot about habitats, or, you know, hollowed out asteroids and so on. But one of the ideas that really sort of resonated with me was, you know, he has this large population that spreads through the solar system, but every 7 years, everyone gets to spend a year back on Earth. And that sort of appealed to me as a way of sort of an equitable way of dealing with the population issue and the fact we only have the one planet at the moment. So, you know, my fantasy extension of this idea, I think, well, perhaps it would work like that. You know, perhaps we would be slightly nomadic in that we would, every few years, we'd spend some time back on Earth and then we'd go back out to a habitat. And I don't know. It's, one other thing is, which I think is, if we do develop, you know, if we do try to colonize Mars, I think it'll be extremely useful to have some of these habitats in orbit there. You would have to, you'd have to have a larger, solar catchment area. You'd have to have a larger optic to catch the sun because the sunlight is so much weaker there, but, yeah, I like to think that people would live reasonably ordinary lives in the sense that you'd have an outdoor landscape that you would use much the same way that we use it here. But you would also have this extraordinary position. Maybe you would be orbiting between the Earth and the Moon. That seems to me the most likely early use of these habitats is that they would be in...
lunar space, yeah.
Orbits with the Earth, over the Earth and the Moon.
I've got a couple of questions sitting here that are asking something similar. So I'll use the one by Alexandria. She's in Atlanta. And she says, is there a plan to do any kind of a demo or test or to put this into action? Or does it only remain as a PowerPoint?
Well, that's a really good question. We've had two grants from NASA already. And we are eligible. These are the NIAC Phase 1 and Phase 2 grants. We are eligible to apply for a Phase 3. NASA instituted the Phase 3 NIAC this year, actually. It was the first one that they awarded to, and Gerald Cicel got one of them. And I'm on Dora's team, I should say, by the way. So, yeah, the intent is that we would try to win a Phase 3. We're not quite ready to do that this year, but I think very soon, maybe next year or the year after, we would have a team together that would apply for a Phase 3 grant. Now, how that works, for anybody who doesn't know, is that you look for a sponsor from industry. And not giving out any prizes, whatever that might be. But we would want to have an industrial sponsor who was looking to develop and then fly this idea. So, yeah, that's where we hope to go with this.
So to get a NIAC Phase 3, you need an actual sponsor from the industry who wants to at least demo it in flight.
Somebody who wants to put some money into developing the hardware that would enable then a demonstration flight in orbit here. We would have to do hardware tests in vacuum chambers here on the ground to demonstrate the growth expansion mechanisms, which are very specific, and I haven't really gone into them in the graphics that I've posted here, but we have very specific methods for accomplishing the expansion, and we want to show that they actually work. So that's how this tends to work, is you do breadboard, as they call them, breadboard demonstrations of hardware And there is a technology readiness level scale called TRL 1 through 9.
Right.
One is sort of theory, maybe could be real, you know, we don't know. We are probably around TRL level 3 or 4 right now with this idea. And we would, in the phase 3 grant, we would try to advance it a couple of notches beyond that to the point where it really looked like you could make, you people could see, yes, we could actually do this. We could make this work. And then it would be a matter of investing the money and to actually fly it in orbit.
What is, how much money does NASA award for a phase 3?
A phase 3, currently, phase 3 is $2 million over 2 years. And the stipulation is they expect you to get money from your industrial sponsor as well.
Plus the industrial money.
Yeah, right. And at the moment, they are sort of planning on awarding one of these a year. That's how the program started out with that intention. This year, they actually awarded two because there were two very, very strong competitors. This coming year, they might not award any. You know, they just have a budget thing to deal with, you know. They just have to manage their budget. But that's what we want to do.
Interesting. What kind of training would do I want to call them a resident or a crewman? What do I want to call the person
okay.
that's living there? And,
okay.
and what do they have
yeah,
to be trained as?
I know where you're going with this. So obviously, to begin with, you would be having professional astronauts, astronaut scientists, researchers, pretty much like they do on the space station currently. People who have very specific skills and are doing very specific research that can only be done in this this environment. It's impossible to really replicate what a rotating environment will be like here on the ground. You simply can't do it because of the gravity field of the Earth. So there's opportunities for unique research. We do not have any idea about how the human body responds to partial gravity. We just don't know. But this habitat like this, you know, even in the early stages will allow you to do research that simply can't be done without that. So to begin with, it would be very research-oriented, you know, very, very much that way. And as the shielding level develops and as the radius increases, then you're going to transition through sort of intermediary kinds of individuals, but at the end of the day, you've got people who might who be considered to be settlers, you know, some of them at least. But it depends a little bit on how the structure is used, and we, like I mentioned before, you can have multiple uses. Something that can hold 8,000 people, you can have a bunch of different uses going on at the same time in there. You know, commercial uses, everything would have to have some commercial basis, just like it does in life here on the ground, you know. We're never separated from those needs. So we'd have to be knit together with the economic fabric of society at large somehow. But you can see that, you know, the tourism, vacations, the cruise ship model, those are all possible revenue streams that could be implemented. And some people might live for a year or two or three. And eventually you might have, you know, families who decide they're going to live there permanently. But I can't really predict exactly how that's going to be. It depends where the habitat is. In the Earth-Moon system, you've always got the door open to come back to the Earth if you want to. You know? Beyond that, it's speculative. I don't know.
So where are you now? What are you're focusing now on the NIAC 3 award, I take it, right?
Well, where we are right now is, I think I mentioned earlier that I personally, and then to some degree some other members of the team did too, almost a full 12 months additional work to bring the design to what you see, you know, in front of you in the more developed images there. And it's quite solid now. It works as a growth model. That part really works. And So I am quite pleased with where we got the but it is still a visionary idea. And so the trick is to translate that into a partnership with industry. And so developing that those relationships is very much the next thing that we want to start doing, is reaching out to potential partners in industry to develop those relationships.
Are you at all limited or hindered in reaching out because of ITAR? Can you go to foreign people, or do you have to stay with the U.S.?
You know, that's a fair question, and I don't actually know for certain about that. I'm not exactly sure. My first impression is that the most likely candidates, and again, mentioning no names, are probably in North America. But, I mean, Branson is, you know, I just don't think Branson is thinking in this direction at the moment. Now, I don't know about anybody else who might be out there. Maybe the Saudis would be interested. I don't know.
Well, of course, they're not in North America, so.
Right. No, I think it would probably stay home here. But.
Do you, well, we're actually coming up on the end, so in just a second I'm going to ask you to summarize the discussion and fill in the blanks on some things that we may have left out or forgotten,
okay,
or omitted. But when you delivered this at the Space Studies Institute, I know you only had probably 10 minutes to present or something like that there, and there you have an audience that's pre-committed to the O'Neillian free space thing, otherwise they're probably not there, right? So I'm curious as to the reaction and the feedback from the group at large. What did you take away from how they saw what you were doing? And there were other space architects and habitat design people there that didn't come close to your design. I've had a couple of them on the show, like Suzanne Bianco, for example, and other that are, you know, in a totally different world, in a totally different direction. So how were you received? How did you're kind of revolutionary compared to what most people are doing.
I think that's true. I mean, I don't say that with any sort of ego about it. I just think it's true. This is a revolutionary idea. And I was as surprised as anybody when I realized that what was falling into my lap was potentially a game changer. So it's been a lot of fun, I have to say. But I think it was very well received, from what I could tell. There were, I think, six or seven people on the panel, and I was the last to present because the idea was the most, you know, the furthest out, so to speak. It was like a historical review, you know.
Okay.
But I think it was well received.
In terms of summary for tonight's program, have we forgotten anything? Is there anything additional that you would like to tell us about? What can you say?
Well, actually, there are a couple of little sort of tidbits I can add. We have developed elevators and lifeboats. I mean, what I'd like to think about that, but yes, we. I don't know that the slide is there, but we have an elevator system that works in the cavity between the shield and the pressure hull. It runs on the inside of the shield, on rails basically, and it runs radially and laterally also. So you can go up and then go sideways. And that's basically like an elevator car that when it's in the right place, it then locks onto the side of the pressure hull when it has to match rotation with it first. And that's what the horizontal rails, the circular rails are for. And that those elevator cars can, in fact, descend all the way down to the bottom of the shield wall and then exit the habitat as free-flying shuttles. They can be designed with the capability to do that. So I think that's kind of cool. And then that idea can be extended to the idea, well, why don't we park a bunch of these at the lower level, and they can function as lifeboats in extremis. So, I mean, you know, it's, when you think of it in comparison to an ocean-going ship, that's one of the functions that an ocean-going ship has, is you have lifeboats just in case, you know.
Right.
There's no reason we couldn't do the same here. And one other thing, which is depressurization, which is the thing that, you know, you worry about. So the structure is sufficiently compartmentalized that I think you'll always have about three barriers between the outside and the large interior space. And any depressurization that occurred is going to be a slow business because you're inside a shield. Nothing big is going to puncture you. The most likely punctures will come from, you know, a nutcase on the inside with a knife. But it's going to be a very slow business, and it'll be very easy to patch, because if you're patching from the inside, you've got atmospheric pressure working with you. So, although I sometimes, early on when I was thinking about it, I would worry about, well, is that an issue? I don't really think it is.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I'd love to talk to you again when you're further developed with NIAC 3.
Sure.
So that's about a year from now, right?
We will certainly know more a year from now.
Well, if something comes up and you want to update us between now and the NIAC 3 reward or award, shoot me an email and we can do an update.
Okay.
But I'd like to follow along and see how it goes and what's new and your progress.
One sort of very small technical footnote about the NIAC program.
Uh-huh.
When the phase three was initially announced, it sounded like they were going to make it so that only current phase twos could actually apply for a phase three.
Okay.
And they made an exception for they're going to make an exception for the first 2 years. But that's all changed. Now it's a free for all. Anybody who has a phase two can apply for a phase three, no matter when you had your phase two.
So
that's good.
But you have to have a phase two to apply for a phase three.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But it's good because we don't have to worry, oh, we must apply, we must get it, we must win it this year. You know, we're no longer
no time requirement anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So it's much better.
Okay.
So
well, keep us
a little more relaxed, yeah.
Keep us posted on your progress. And
we'll do.
It sounds fascinating and looks fascinating, and I'd love to see a 3D model of it, how it works.
Well, I actually have a 3D printed model. The University of Texas A&M has it, but we did build a 3D model of you, so.
You ought to have a video of showing it and how it works.
I can probably send that to you.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I probably can't put a video on my website.
I can get you that link so that you have access to it.
Okay. Can we put the link on the website?
I'm sure you can, yeah.
Or is it copyrighted or something?
No, I think it's owned by the nation. You know, it's paid for by taxpayers.
All right. Or you can post it and just tell me it's up there and then I'll go do it. All right.
Very good. I will do that.
All right. I will get this program up and running and archived and send you the details. And good luck going forward. And we look forward to hearing more from you down the road.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for tonight. So remember, check the website to make sure we're on for tomorrow, but hopefully we are, and I'm looking forward to our program. You can read about it in the newsletters and on the upcoming show menu. And we certainly want to thank all of you for emailing your questions to Anthony tonight. And we're saying goodnight, so goodnight from Anthony, David, and the Space Show. And everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Don't play with matches. And I hope your electricity works. Good night from the Space Show.